And good morning. You are tuned to Community Radio, listeners supported KGNU. I'm Steve Miller, and coming up on today's Morning Magazine, as coronavirus forces thousands of Colorado students to switch to remote learning, we'll hear from a CU assistant professor on the challenges and opportunities of virtual education. Then we'll hear from workers and unions that represent them that are calling for more protection and support for those workers, particularly low-wage workers. Then, with arts and cultural events closed, what does that mean for galleries and theaters? At the bottom of the hour, it's time for Connections, and today Duncan Campbell will be joined by guest Lisa Graves, who is the chair of the Center for Media and Democracy. But first, we'll begin with the latest headlines. The number of confirmed novel coronavirus cases in the state continues to grow. Maeve Conran has more.
Boulder County now has 16 of its residents confirmed positive for the novel coronavirus. There are more than 216 confirmed cases statewide. 20 of the 64 counties in Colorado now have at least one case, with 33 confirmed cases in Denver. That's the most of any county. Testing remains an issue, with people who have notes from their doctors still struggling to find a location to get tested. In San Miguel County, however, every resident is being tested regardless of whether they have symptoms. It is the first known place in the country that's testing on such a mass scale. Researchers and county public health experts say that they are hoping that it will provide data on how the disease is widespread and how strict quarantine measures might help the contagion. An international biomedical company whose executives have ties to Telluride is paying for the tests. For KGNU, I'm Maeve Conran.
Colorado businesses are getting creative as they face layoffs or permanent closures. The Colorado Sun reports that some are sharing their coronavirus survival strategies. At Project Rise Fitness in Denver this week, the gym began loaning out equipment in exchange for a cash deposit to keep members exercising at home and cash flowing for the business. The Denver Beer Company will host its first virtual happy hour today at 4 p.m. with tastings of five different beers. Go to their website for further information. The Game Lounge, a board game-themed restaurant in Denver's Park Hill neighborhood, besides offering takeout and delivery, has included board rentals for $5 an overnight or $20 for unlimited use. The Color Me Mind store in Chapel Hills Mall in Colorado Springs are packing up take-home painting kits for children. Lots of distilleries have turned to making hand sanitizers, partly to meet the demand in the world of COVID-19, but also to give employees something to do. Project Rise Fitness in Denver has daily workouts in its virtual portal that members could access at home, and they are also offering rental equipment for members for a refund deposit. Then, buying a gift card will help local businesses that rely on cash to keep going. Websites like helpmainstreet.com help communities map out these local businesses. Finally, the Broomfield Chamber of Commerce is posting updates from local businesses to share hours, specials, and delivery options on the Chamber's Facebook page. Today's weather, mostly cloudy, chance of snow and areas of fog, high in the mid-30s today. Saturday, partly foggy, then partly sunny, high around 50. And then Sunday, mostly sunny and the chance of showers in the afternoon, high in the mid-50s. This week, Governor Jared Polis announced all Colorado schools would remain closed until April 17th. And as a result, thousands of students and teachers are now relying on technology for remote and online learning. Dr. Jose Ramon Lizarraga is an assistant professor of learning sciences and human development at the University of Colorado Boulder. He's been investigating the role of social networks, television, and other digital media plays in teacher and youth learning. Dr. Lizarraga spoke with KGNU's Hannah Lee Myers about his research and shared his thought and advice on the mass switch to digital learning as the result of the COVID-19 outbreak.
I think there has been a lot of research that has happened for a long time around what good pedagogy and good learning looks like in the face-to-face. And in many ways, the digital has to catch up, right? And we have to catch up in ways where we're not just getting caught up in the newfangledness of new technologies, but rather paying attention closely to the social aspects of learning. And how does one attend to the social organization of learning, much like we do in person? How do we do that in the digital terrain as well? And I think we're still in a space where we don't know exactly how we create digital environments where learners are able to actively apply what they're learning rather than just, you know, regurgitating facts or just memorizing content.
And I know you've worked on the intersection between digital learning and traditionally marginalized communities. What can you tell us about that research and what you found and the status of that intersection?
Yeah, you know, that has been my focus for a while. And I think some of my early research as a PhD student at UC Berkeley involved doing some really comprehensive analyses and comprehensive research on how marginalized communities actually use the technologies or engaging with the idea of the digital divide, right? And what we have found is that increasingly Latinx and other marginalized communities have more and more access to technologies. And in fact, that gap has been closing consistently in the past years. One of the primary concerns definitely still is around access to technology and access to a broadband internet. And that is a infrastructure issue that I think we can continue to advance and propose as something that needs to be attended to the powers that be. But we do see that there is a closing of a gap between marginalized communities and not so marginalized communities in terms of access. And we want to continue to leverage that closing of that gap when we're working with marginalized communities and their learning.
So let's discuss this in light of the current coronavirus COVID-19 crisis. With so many teachers and educators and students switching to digital learning, what's your professional opinion here? What insight do you have and what thoughts would you share considering your research?
Right. I think one of the things that I have been kind of engaging with all day today and all the meetings, because we've been having all these meetings about these very concerns, is that one, in the next couple of weeks, it's not just about conducting business as usual, that in fact we are, in a sense, in a mode of crisis, that there's something happening in the world that is impacting all of us. And so one of the things that I've been working towards doing is making sure that we're attending to the actual current social conditions that we're in as we are engaging in learning with our kids, right? That as we're talking to our kids, that we're working with our kids, we're actively talking about COVID, or we're talking about the crises that we are engaging with in our world right now. I think we need to be kind of patient and kind to each other. One of the questions that kept coming up, because this modality of doing the virtual is so new for a lot of our faculty, is what do we do when the technology fails, right? And that's one of the biggest fears that our instructors and teachers have right now, is that somehow they'll lose control of the classroom or learning if the technology fails. And so that's part of that patience part of it, right? That the technology will fail and that you just have to roll with the punches sometimes.
And any other advice or insight you have for teachers, educators, students, and I guess all of us, considering so many of us are switching to digital learning or a digital workplace, and I'm sure are making all sorts of mistakes. Are there mistakes you're seeing being made that bother you, that maybe you can give us some insight to put us on a better course and in a better direction with all this?
Yeah, you know, some of the things that have been grinding my gears are, one, that there's this idea that we can completely move in-person learning to online, like just superimpose it or like put it into this nice little package, digital package. And so one of the things that I think I've been working with and helping not only my colleagues with, but my teachers, the teachers that I work with, is that there's a different engagement with learning and pedagogy that we need to shift towards as soon as we start thinking about the digital, which makes it really uncomfortable, right? Because it doesn't feel as secure or as familiar as kind of the usual ways that we do things. And so the way that I would answer that kind of query is that you know, we are not going to have it down. There's no way that we can completely, in a matter of 2 weeks, transform an in-person type of classroom environment into a virtual environment. And we're going to have to be okay with that for now. And yeah, I think one of the things that also kind of has been bothering me a little bit is that people get really excited about just using all of these, like, saturating their learning spaces with all these crazy tools that maybe actually don't help learning. But we try to use the tools that, at the very least, allow us to connect a learner to a teacher or learner to a learner. And sometimes that means that you're not using the most up-to-date, like, fancy software, but maybe it's just about, like, making sure that you're connected, even if it is email, even if it is more of a text-based, even if it's not video or something super fancy. So how do we keep it more simple, right? Start from simplicity rather than starting from complexity when it comes to shifting to the online. The more simple, the better at this point. And the last thing I think that I want to kind of underscore is that this is an opportunity for us to actually learn from our kids and learn from youth and help have them help us design good learning, right? Often these kids know how to use technologies better than we do. And so how do we leverage that in this environment for the purposes of doing a little bit more co-learning and co-designing of learning alongside with kids?
And that was Dr. Jose Ramon Lizarraga, an assistant professor of learning sciences and human development at the University of Colorado Boulder, speaking to us about pros, cons, and best practices as students, teachers, and workers switch to remote and learning during coronavirus quarantine. With the economic impacts of the COVID-19 pandemic becoming more apparent every day, workers' rights advocates and unions are calling for more protection for low-wage workers who are being disproportionately impacted. Reese Greiner has more.
The COVID-19 pandemic is affecting day-to-day life all over the globe, and as the number of confirmed cases grows in Colorado, workers are concerned. The Service Employees International Union, Local 105, hosted a web conference to voice these worries and to share stories from workers on the front lines. Ron Ruggiero, president of the SEIU Local 105, set the stakes of the conversation.
The COVID-19 outbreak across this country is exposing the deep flaws in a low-wage economy. And those flaws make all of us more vulnerable in normal times, and they certainly are put into stark relief in a crisis such as this.
Ruggiero pointed to the U.S. government's focus on corporations and not workers as part of the problem.
Currently across the country, and especially in D.C., there's a ton of talk about, you know, the need for corporate bailouts. And I think what you're going to hear today is a need for a people's bailout and a workers' bailout.
Millions of Americans are being put out of work due to workplace closings or quarantines, but
the bulk of Colorado workers do not have the luxury to do their job from home.
Dennis Daugherty, executive director of the Colorado AFL-CIO, said that many don't have that option. Testimonies from a variety of workers were given to appeal to a more worker-centered response to COVID-19.
Today, you're going to hear from workers who take care of others, healthcare professional.
It is irresponsible for us as a community to force our dedicated workers to make a decision to themselves at home or to come to work being sick for the basic necessities of life.
Janitor.
A lot of my coworkers don't have adequate materials to combat this epidemic.
Airport worker.
To ensure the safety of these passengers, there should be procedures to keep these people safe. We are not seeing any activities from companies to help protect airport workers.
Teacher.
We need to ensure that our leaders have people as their priority. When we take care of our educators, they will be able to take care of our students.
A firefighter.
We're looking for hopefully some sort of direction nationally or by the state that allows everybody to be able to call off sick when they need to and not when they just get a positive test result.
Flight attendant.
We need to be able to earn income and care for our children. We need to be able to self-quarantine if we feel ill without suffering a loss of pay. We need better access to testing for all hospitality workers.
Home health care worker.
We are very concerned, as everyone should be and everyone is, about the future and the length of time that this is going to continue and how we're going to support ourselves and our families.
Ruggiero ended the conference call by urging leaders to take the majority of Americans into consideration as this crisis is weathered.
Last time I checked, corporate America had over $4 trillion in cash. And in contrast, in a recent poll of Americans, basically half of Americans cannot afford a $400 emergency.
This has been Reese Greiner.
The pandemic is also impacting the cultural and arts community in the state, with galleries and theaters closed and events canceled. Lucy Haggard has more.
Over the course of just a few months, the 2019 novel coronavirus pandemic has drastically altered the world and its functions. For the U.S., it's been a chaotic few weeks, to say the least, and this is only the beginning. To understand the speed of it all and its impacts, look no further than the arts and culture industry.
This is an unprecedented set of circumstances. So my name is Andrea Malcolm, and I am the museum director at Historic Denver's Molly Brown House Museum.
As of Saturday, the museum closed its doors. In the decades that Malcolm has been with the Molly Brown House prior to the pandemic,
the most we've ever had to decide on closures is when Colorado has one of our lovely snow days.
The museum is just one of many arts and culture organizations in the metro area and around the state and country that have been forced to close to mitigate the spread of COVID-19. For a performing arts perspective, take the Arvada Center.
We started by trying to preserve as much of our programming as possible in a way that was responsible.
Philip Sneed, president and CEO.
So we first stepped up our cleaning and disinfecting routine, and we're trying to follow all the guidelines that were available. And at first we thought, well, let's try a 3-week closure and see if that will do it. But it just became untenable to do anything other than cancel everything for the next couple of months and close the building entirely.
COVID-19 is highly contagious. Governments from the local to national scale have advised and even mandated that people take measures to limit the spread of the virus. In Colorado, Governor Jared Polis has asked most people to work from home and avoid gathering in groups larger than 10 people. But it's hard to work from home when your office is a stage, and like other industries, the arts are experiencing rolling layoffs.
The production staff, the ones that are on seasonal contracts and to build the sets and the costumes and the props and all of that, trying to find a way to keep them on as long as possible so that their seasonal hiatus is not any longer than it was going to be, but it's going to be a challenge.
Of course, this isn't just the Arvada Center. Cultural organizations often operate under incredibly tight budgets that depend on staying open in all senses of the word. Kelly Duncan, president and CEO of the Community First Foundation, knows this all too well.
So many industries and so many nonprofits are going to be impacted by this. But I think specifically what we see with some of these cultural institutions is the majority of their revenue comes from ticket sales. So that's a huge hit on their budget. While they still have to pay rent, they still have to employ their staff, they still have to cover their overhead expenses, and yet their primary source of revenue has been cut off.
And it's not just artists themselves who are impacted when the industry experiences a flux like this.
You know, it's all interrelated. It's sort of an ecosystem.
Gary Stoyer is with the Bonfils Stanton Foundation, which offers grants and fellowships to enrich the arts in Denver.
The arts sector is very much dependent, of course, on artists. They are the product. And many of the artists are also teaching. And so they're teachers as well. So when schools are shut down, it impacts their income as teachers. And they're also bartenders and waiters and Lyft and Uber drivers. I think we have to look, as we come out on the other side of this and look at recovery, we have to look at it in a way that looks at our whole society. And we, you know, healthcare, and we need teachers, and we need human services, and we need arts and culture.
In that spirit, the foundation took matters into its own hands.
We determined that what we needed to do was just immediately push some emergency funding out to all the organizations that we already fund. We ended up making grants equal to 10% of their most recent grant amount, and literally just informed them we were doing this and put the checks in the mail. There was no application process, no restrictions on the funding. This was not a business as usual situation. Right now, the uncertainty over how long this period will last is kind of the big variable. We certainly realized when we did this that it was going to be a drop in the bucket compared to the need. So yes, absolutely, there needs to be a larger effort.
For the rest of the state's cultural institutions, there are a few options available to try and weather the storm. One is emergency funding from the state and federal legislatures, both of which are working on aid packages aimed at buffering the economic impact of the pandemic in a variety of industries. It's still up in the air whether or not arts and cultural groups will qualify in these bills. Another option takes the crowdfunding route. A GoFundMe, titled Denver Metro Area Artist COVID-19 Relief Fund, is just one of many that's taking the artist-specific approach. According to its page, the fund's operators review individual applications for funds that would take the place of payments from canceled performances and more. For organizations that are part of a coalition, like the Community First Foundation's Colorado Gives Network,
we're letting them know and we're letting their donors know that they can create fundraising pages in response to COVID-19 that they can send out to their networks to help mitigate some of the financial hardships that they're going to see as a result of the social distancing and some of the shutting down of typical activities.
Speaking of those canceled performances, what happens with the tickets? Some sellers are opting to wait it out in hopes that concerts can be rescheduled. For others, they're giving would-be attendees a choice. Get a full refund, transfer the ticket credit to a post-pandemic show, or just donate the ticket's cost outright. The Arvada Center is offering all three of those options, but Sneed says that even if every ticket holder donated the cost of their ticket outright, it still wouldn't make up for other odds and ends funding sources. And yet,
what's not necessarily helpful is if someone says, well, I'll give you next year's gift now, because then, you know, we're short that money next year. Granted, we need it now more than next year, but we're also trying to find a way to get through this short term without too much compromise on, you know, next year and beyond.
Homebound Coloradans might be hoping to watch a performance from the comfort of their abode, whether it's an encore presentation from the Metropolitan Opera or from their local playhouse. But many smaller operations haven't built out streaming capacity yet.
You know, outside of a few theaters, most theaters have not been streaming, and they don't have anything recorded. And to do a live stream would mean assembling the actors and the crew and others, and that's a group of a few dozen people, and we shouldn't gather in groups of more than 10. So since we don't have any backlog on video to record, that we could, you know, put out there, there's really no option to do that.
And as Stoyer points out, proper solutions for the arts industry and the economy as a whole need to involve more than just virtual shows.
The fact is, arts workers are workers too. So when you talk about unemployment, you're talking about arts workers who are also unemployed, and you're talking about the multiplier effect, the economic impact of the arts, and what a huge impact that is both locally and statewide. Because when people participate in the arts, they hire babysitters, they go out to dinner, they buy things in the gift shop. So it's not that the arts are sort of competitive with the other crucial social needs that we're going to have going forward. It's that they're part of those needs.
Multiple museums have gone digital to create Google Earth-style exploring experiences. Soon, the Molly Brown House will release its own virtual tour. Until then, Malcolm says Instagram posts help people engage with the museum's artifacts, and as long as it's still okay to take walks in public, folks can take a self-guided tour of the city's history through architecture. It's still not the same as people paying admission and buying merchandise, but Malcolm says that at least the museum's website can help keep the public engaged and interested. It all goes back to the resilience of their namesake lady.
We are so fortunate at the Molly Brown House Museum to have the story of Margaret, or Molly Brown, who has faced so much adversity in her life, including the Titanic disaster, major hotel fire she was involved in, of course, her work during World War I. So we hope that we can continue to inspire our community. She has this unsinkable Colorado spirit and a legacy that we hope people can continue to connect with. So we're going to encourage people to find ways to sort of rally through this situation and find that Denver spirit and continue to tell Denver stories with us.
For KGNU, I'm Lucy Haggard.